Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this weekend show. Shad had a little bit of a break at the tail end of the week, but he'll be back with us early next week. Now this weekend show, I'm going to take a step back and look broadly, big picture, at the markets. Not just commodities, but U.S. equity markets, currencies, and the bond market because, look, let's face it, we seem to be in the middle of summer trading. Summer trading is slow, and that gives us the ability to take a step back and see maybe what the markets are telling us about where we could be going once we get out of this slow summer trading season. No time frame on how long this summer trading is going to last, but we can at least see some of the moves going on slowly under the surface to analyze, well, just where the markets and key trends are moving. I am kicking off the first two segments here with our good friend Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. Also writes a retail newsletter called In the No Trader. And again, I've mentioned it before, Rick also writes this new piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs. Now, Rick, big picture, you can't look at any financial website and not see the term inflation thrown around in many articles, and any market commentary always has that inflation comment tied to whatever comment that author is making. Rick, what do you think? Is inflation the most important thing that investors need to be considering day after day right now?
Well, hi, Corey. I think it's a combination of looking at actual inflation numbers and then also how are investors positioned for what they expect in the future as far as inflation. And it's a combination of that that I think right now is probably the most important two things to be looking at as the basis for not only trading the bond market, but also its influence on the equity markets. And so, you know, we can kind of let's talk about that piecemeal. As far as actual inflation, well, the CPI and PPI numbers came out and kind of very clearly show that we have much higher inflation than was expected. Clearly much higher than the Fed expected. And it's real. I mean, these, especially, you know, when you take out, I never love the idea of taking out the what they call, quote, the volatile food and energy piece of it, because to the average consumer, I'm not sure there is anything more important than the price of food that they pay in a grocery store and the price they pay at the gas station to fill up their cars. These are things that you can't live without. You've got to eat and you've got to be able to get around. So, I still kind of chuckle at the fact that they'll say, let's take a look at some of these numbers without food and energy. Secondly, investors are still, despite the fact that the 10-year has gone from, what was it, 1.75 on the high this year down to about 1.3 right now, they are still positioned for upcoming inflation. And they've been correct. If anything, I'd say Fed Chairman Powell has been incorrect, where he's purposely trying to make this less of an issue than the investing public sees it to be. Even with rates having come down and spreads having narrowed, the reality is that with a 1.3% 10-year that bottomed last week at 1.25, bounced up to actually got over a little over 1.4 and then has, you know, slid down to 1.3 today. The marketplace is still showing, despite the 40 bips of pullback in, or 45 bips in pullback that we've seen over the course of the last 3-4 months, inflation is still a concern for investors. And on the front cover of our supposedly irrelevant factors report that goes out to institutions, my clients each week, we actually show a table of 10 different markets. And depending upon which ones are in bullish formation on the charts, we actually can get a pretty good clue of how investors are gauging upcoming inflationary pressures. And since last September, it has continuously shown inflationary concerns. And investors have been right because inflation has moved up significantly. So this is, you know, despite the fact that lumber has fallen and given back almost the entire 2000, in fact, I think it has given up the entire 2021 rally, it's still well above where it was from pre-pandemic levels of a year and a half ago. But despite that, and despite the fact that oil's come off 10% or so from the high, you're still talking about $70 crude, and we were at 40 bucks. So there really is inflation that affects people's pocketbook, and you're not seeing wage increases anything close to offsetting that. The money you get in the bank, or let's say that, you know, even a 10-year yield at 1.3% does you nothing of no good when you've got inflation running where it is now. So it, in many ways, this is truly an issue for the investing public, both professional investors, but also, you know, mom and pop, the retail investor, who's still trying to figure out this game of what to do and how much money to keep in cash. And you know, can you still fuel the equity market because there's nowhere else to put your money? And these are the ongoing issues.
Now, Rick, isn't that the key point? And something that not a whole lot of people have talked about is that even with higher inflation expectations, in a way, does that not make the mom and pop investor, even bigger institutions, say that they need to have their money at work, which means their money needs to be in the markets, which helps support the market?
Well, it does, but it also, the problem becomes that, and the Fed's done this now for, you know, years, as interest rates went lower and lower, you got pushed into riskier assets because, especially, look, take a 65-year-old or a 70-year-old in the U.S. who, or in Canada, they rely somewhat on Social Security, but they also, at this point in their lives, have generally moved well away from being in the stock market, and the bulk of their portfolio is in fixed income instruments. And when they're yielding as little as they are, people are having a real hard time making ends meet. The average person is having a difficult time. And this is the issue for them, because if you're 70 years old, you don't want to be forced into the risky equity market. And look, it's done phenomenally well for people who put their money in equities, were virtually on all-time highs. So you've had a phenomenal run. But at some point, that's going to correct. And you don't want to be a 70-year-old when the market decides to correct 20 or 25%. That's hugely painful. So this is a real issue. It obviously, depending upon what your age is, affects you more or less, you know, if you're older or not. But the reality is that putting money in the bank, or we're taking 1.3% from the U.S. government on a 10-year instrument simply to get 1.3% is not a particularly good deal. More specifically, if bond yields break further and we get down towards, I'd say, 1.18, 1.15, somewhere in there, that's probably the area that I walk away from all of my bond investments that I've had and walk away for good, because it simply doesn't do me any good to have my money there. It's because if rates ultimately go higher, which I think they will, then you're going to lose money. You're going to lose more money holding your bonds As rates go higher, the price of bonds go lower. And most people, we had a, let's call it a 40-year bull market in bonds, right? In round numbers, let's say from 1980 to 2020, bonds went up. And people not only got the yield on the bonds, but they had tremendous capital appreciation. To me, those days are done. And we're not going back down to the 40 basis points low that we saw last year. I doubt we break under 1%. And if we do, from the first week in January this year, there's a gap, an unfilled price gap in the 10-year from just about 1% down to 95 basis points or so. So to me, if we get anything near there, which I'd say is if you're at 115, 1.15, anything around there, all the way down to 95 bips, is where I will be telling everyone to say goodbye to bonds forever, because you lose money if unless rates crumble and go back down to 2020 lows, you're going to lose money on the bonds as rates move higher. You're locking in, let's say, 1%, even if it's 1.2%, you're locking that in. And as rates go higher, you'll collect your 1.2%, but you're gonna lose it on the fact that your money's worth less because of inflation going higher. And your bonds, to me, we've started a secular bear market in bonds, such that there's no value to holding the bonds other than you guarantee yourself the meager return at the cost of price loss on the actual bonds themselves. It's just a bad deal. So if you're not a pension fund, an endowment fund, somebody who just has to have bonds, then for the average person, to me, it's not the right asset to be in. And the Fed has essentially forced you to go into equities because there is nowhere else to put your money. And yes, you could go into cryptos, you could go into gold. I mean, there are some alternative assets, but generally, most people look at the equity market and the bond market as the bulk of where their investable dollars are going to go. And it's the danger of having all the kind of free money and, you know, that the Fed continually pumps into the marketplace. Once that stops and the game changes and they're not fueling the bull market, then you need corporate profits and, you know, just good old standard stuff on its own to drive you higher. But if you don't have the Fed, and at some point they are going to taper back. And, you know, if rates ultimately, let's say the 10-year makes its way up to 3.5% over the next couple of years, where do you think stocks are going to go when people start having some alternative? If you can get 3.5% on your money and it's U.S. federal tax free, then it starts becoming a possible alternative to taking on the risk of the equity market. But at 1.2%, 1.3%, 1%, to me, there's no deal there at all. It's a losing deal.
Fair enough, Rick. And really, it sounds like what you're outlining here is that the potential downside for investing in bonds far outweighs any sort of minimal upside you might get in terms of the capital gains aspect. And then you're not getting any yield on it, especially at current levels, right? Or at least not attractive yields. But I do want to circle back around to your comment on inflation and some of the market showing you that, you know, inflation is still around. Look at where copper is. Look at where oil is, right? Even lumber is still a little bit higher than its pre-pandemic levels. But what about the gold market? I thought gold was supposed to be the best hedge against inflation. And yeah, gold's up, but if you actually go back to pre-pandemic, so let's look at the high from March of last year, it was right around 1700. That was the exact high. And right now we're at 1800 in gold. So that's not a huge move for how much inflation we're seeing. What's the disconnect here?
I think the disconnect is that you started getting some alternative asset classes, more specifically cryptos, that people have decided to put some money in as a hedge against a falling U.S. dollar as a hedge against just, you know, governments controlling the flow of money as compared to individuals. So, you know, the crypto market has taken, if that didn't exist, I suspect the price of gold would be far higher. But gold peaked in the summer, I think it was August of last year. And it, in the big decline that you saw in gold from, you know, over, I don't know, what was it? Must be something near 2075, give or take, was the all-time high, down to the move at 1675 earlier this year. That's a $400 drop. That's, you know, 20%. And I think it's because cryptos have taken, let's call it, money flow away from the gold market, the you know, just somewhere else to park your money. And when Bitcoin moved up as much as it did, people started just getting in who know nothing about it, but just kind of go, like, I want to be a part of it. And of course, at this point, a lot of those people have losses because Bitcoin topped at, what, $63,000, $64,000, and now it's half of that. So not a surprise that people were, you know, some people are getting really badly crushed in the crypto space, but I think that has something to do with why gold isn't higher than it would have been. I do actually like where gold recently bottomed a month ago. I bought some more. It's, when gold got to 1775, I bought some more GLD for myself. And I, in general, it's, you know, it's kind of bounced and done decently. I really would not want to see those lows taken out under 1750, somewhere around there. At that point, I think gold is in trouble. And we could easily get back to 1675 and, you know, kind of the lows that we saw early this year. And if those levels give way, then gold can go to $1,500 and it makes it a much more questionable type of hold over time. So we just recently stopped somewhere near, I don't know, 1835, give or take, and we're trading 1815 or so. So, you know, we've bounced. We're holding on to that. The dollar hasn't rallied all that much more since, you know, in the last couple, the last week or so, it's been fairly steady. And I think that from what I read, the fundamentals are still decent for gold. But you've got to kind of listen to what the market tells you too. And right now, you really don't want to see 1750 taken out on the downside.
Okay. Hey, Rick, very clear target right there. And then right after 1750, yeah, you got to look to that 1675 almost level of that most recent low this year. Now, Rick, let's then go to the U.S. equity markets in terms of individual sectors. Any opportunities that you're seeing? This kind of ties into your 7-11 piece where you pick 7 of the 11 spider ETFs, maximum of 7, that is. Right now, it seems like we have a lot of money concentrated in big tech and growth. That rotation has gone back there, and even with weak breadth for the markets, so just a limited number of stocks holding these markets up, that's where the money has flowed. Do you still see an opportunity here? What sectors do you like within these markets?
Well, so it's kind of a mixture because the lower interest rates, the pullback helps big cap tech. And we've seen them outperform very nicely over the cyclical areas like industrials, financials, energy, materials over the last couple months. As interest rates pulled back, that's a real boost for large cap equity, large cap tech. And we've seen tech outperform significantly. In fact, since June 1st, I put this in a piece I wrote last week for In the Know Trader. If I remember correctly, tech and maybe one other sector was up since June 1st and everything else was trailing the S&P. So the question becomes, when do rates bottom? And at what point do, if we keep going down in rates, at some point that's going to be a negative for the growth, big cap tech too. It's certainly not good for financials. You've seen energy names come off significantly. As of yesterday's close, I saw, you know, XOP and XLE, benchmarks for the energy area, you know, trading on their lowest level in 3 months or so. So oil itself has come off about 10%, but these names have come off far more than that. And the low interest rates is not particularly good for those, you know, for the cyclical parts. So you've got a smattering of sectors here now that are kind of, I still like tech. I'm overweight tech. I am overweight financials because I think that financials, this is a tactical type move in the, let's say, the XLF. The decline is more tactical. It's not strategic, meaning that it's short term. And we try to look out at least 6 months in where we hold a max of the seven. So we look, just to make it clear, we hold no less than five and no more than seven of the 11 macro spider ETFs. So in other words, XLF for financials, XLK for technology, and so on. There are 11 sectors to the S&P 500. And we are outperforming with, we started the 7-Eleven market report last August 1st. As of June 30th, 10 months into the first year, we are outperforming the S&P by 371 basis points, simply by being in the right sectors at the right time and in avoiding, for, you know, we've avoided utilities, we've avoided staples. I've been out of healthcare since January 1st. I have not been in real estate, I think, at all. And even though real estate is probably the second best performer year to date, I still didn't have enough to go actually overweight them. So we've been able to avoid generally the underperformers and stay, you know, our head above water in the outperformers. And look, if you're in the money management industry, or you're doing this for yourself at home and you say, yeah, I could just buy spiders and get the S&P's return. The subscription cost on this is less than $100 a month. And we've got you outperforming the S&P by 3.71%. So depending upon, you know, if you have $100,000 in the market and you're outperforming by 3.71%, you know, you've made three times the cost of the subscription. It's, if not four times, it's significant. And it's simply, you know, looking at the fundamentals, the quantitative models, and the technical view, and putting those together to figure out what are the sectors to be in. And right now, I told you we're overweight tech, we're overweight, let's see, still some of the cyclical parts, because again, I think this is a short-term decline, and we're basically stay away from. So I'm not in healthcare, I'm not in utilities, I'm not in staples, I'm not in real estate. I think those are the four I'm not in currently. So it's a little of this, you know, I've got cyclicals and growth on, and so far it's working.
Very interesting, right? Kind of a balance there too, and it doesn't sound like
you're... Yeah, a little barbell.
Exactly, mm-hmm. But you're not getting sucked in like... I don't know. It seems like we've been hearing from everybody. Oh, everybody's in tech. You have to be in growth. You have to be in large tech. Doesn't sound like that's where you are necessarily, but you are at least positioned in some of those as well, right? So I think it's all about where markets go from here.
Where do markets go from here? I was talking to an institutional client yesterday and saying, I just have a little hunch that we're getting closer towards a top. 4,400 in the S&P to 4,500. I don't think we go beyond that without some type of pullback. And it doesn't, you know, I know, you know, Mike Wilson at Morgan Stanley, my old shop where I had been chief strategist, he's calling for a 10 to 15% market decline. I don't think we're going to see that. Credit markets are not showing in any way that a sell-off like that is imminent. You see a problem show up in the credit markets if there was real stress and concerns about what was coming. And right now, I don't see that with the credit spreads that I monitor. They've moved up a couple of basis points in the last week or two, but nothing significant. And so for right now, I'm not agreeing at all with Mike on that call. In 2014, a month or so before I parted with Wells Fargo, I put out a piece that at the time got a little buzz, but mostly because it seemed like an outlandish call. The S&P was trading at 2,200 in June of 2014, and I said that within 10 years, the S&P would be at 5,000. That's more than a double. And people said I was nuts and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, here we are in 2021, and we're already in the 4,300s. We're only 700 points away. I don't think we get much, you know, like, so if I'm right that it's going to take those 10 years to kind of get there, then there isn't all that much more upside in the immediate future. So I'm very careful about the type stocks I buy now. I'll only buy stuff on pullbacks that look like they have really solid fundamentals, good earnings revisions, and show downside exhaustion in the models that I look at from a timing perspective, so that I'm buying something that has to some degree gotten beaten up, but still has analysts loving the name and, you know, good upside to the analyst target. So I'll give you an example. Like last week, I bought Fiserv for myself, FISV. It's got good fundamentals. It's got really good solid upside of like, I think it's 30% or more to target. It's got downside exhaustion signals on the type stuff that I look at. And I paid 108 and change. And this morning I looked, it was trading 111. You know, so it's up a few percent in a time that the market's really not up much at all. It's that type of stuff where if I'm going to put money into the market now, I don't buy something on new all-time highs. I buy something that's been knocked down but still has the fundamental community behind it and positive earnings revisions.
Okay, that makes sense, Rick. Hey, Rick, it's always great having you on the show. Thank you for this update on where exactly you're trading, where you see these markets positioned. And as I said on the onset, now is the time to do that because it's slow trading and we need to understand where these markets are going to move post this summer slow trading session. Rick, it's great having you on the show, as I mentioned. Thank you, as always, for your time. We'll chat again in approximately another month. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend and great rest of the month of July, Rick. Thank you.
You too, Corey. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Rick Bensignor. We were really focused on broadly what's going on in these markets, and that is going to continue to be the theme of this weekend show, as I am now chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. Now, Dana, look, fact of the matter is, these markets are boring. Hardly any market right now is really screaming in either direction. Seems like everything is range bound, some with a little maybe upside bias if you're looking at big cap tech. But really, overall, feels like we're in the middle of summer and everyone forgot what summer feels like because last summer was so wild and crazy. What's your strategy during times like these, Dana, when, look, it doesn't seem like we're going to be getting any major moves in the near term? How do you trade these markets?
Yeah, that's right, Corey. Well, after, you know, after the move we saw post-election last year into maybe call it March or so, we had a historic rally after that. And following those types of rallies, you see kind of consolidation, kind of the market moves sideways, work off those excesses. So I still think we're seeing that. Combine that with some seasonality, where this is the kind of the kind of the norm for these summer months, for us to go pretty much sideways to maybe a little bit lower into the fall, which is pretty much what we're seeing here in the broader market. Now, there are pockets of strength, which there always are. So one part of our strategy is to continue, as we always do, to try to concentrate our portfolio in those areas that are still performing well, which, as you mentioned, you know, large cap, large growth, technology, healthcare, mostly in those areas, and riding those positions higher. At the same time, trying to trade more of the two-way market in terms of the trading range, you know, buy the dips, sell the rips. Don't expect too much. Don't expect breakouts all over the place as we remain range bound. So trying to hit singles for the most part in most of the markets, outside of some of those areas I mentioned that are running higher, like large cap growth and tech and healthcare, and we'll ride those higher. But for the most part, try not to overtrade. Trying not to again, anticipate breakouts or breakdowns, more or less buy weakness, sell strength, and try to pick up a few pennies here and there.
So, Dana, you are correct about that rip higher that the market saw at the tail end of last year through about March. You can even make the argument really through a couple weeks ago when these markets did just keep on grinding higher. I'm looking at a monthly chart for the S&P 500, and over the last about 15, 16 months, the market's only been down three of those, and those were marginally down, not even big drops, except for slightly more weakness in September. Do you consider these markets safe? Do you consider them overvalued? What's your overall assessment of the health of these markets?
Well, on the one hand, you have to consider the period that we're coming off, that like I mentioned, that post-election rally. So the sideways market is not unusual for that type of market. On the other hand, there, when you say the market, there are many things you can call the market. Which we normally term the market is the broad market. So the whole wide collection of stocks in the U.S. market, the thousands and thousands of stocks, which represent the broad market. And that, for us, measuring that is the most important factor in measuring the health of the overall market, as we call it. So when you have, you know, positive breadth, a good level of participation among the broad market of stocks, then you have a healthy market, then you have a sustainable bull market. When you have the large cap indices hitting new highs and yet the breadth is poor or weak, and you have a very, very low participation rate among the broader market of stocks, then that's less sustainable. And that's basically what we have right now. So that can last for a while, but it has lasted for almost 2 months now. And up until a couple weeks ago, we were willing to write it off because basically it wasn't reaching extreme alarming levels, but now it is. So starting a couple weeks ago, our risk management antennas really went off and had us rein in some of our exposure in the market, given the breadth divergences, given the weak breadth. So we do expect some more reckoning here in the near to intermediate term in the overall market. At the same time, some of these large cap averages can remain buoyant for a time, but typically before you get the next leg up in the market after the kind of breadth divergence that we're seeing now, you have some sort of reckoning across the markets, even those areas that are acting well, areas that I mentioned before. Typically you see those sell off as well for a bit before we bottom and start rallying on a more sustainable basis, because they'll start selling what they can at some point when we get into a sharper correction on top of what has already been sold off, which is, you know, a lot of the small cap stuff and some of the other sectors. But Again, we think still that eventually, once this little reckoning is over with, that we do, we are in, still in good shape to break out and put a, at least one more up leg in the bull market before this whole thing is over. So maybe some more sideways to corrective action in the near to intermediate term, followed by another rally, and then maybe that's it.
What does a safety trade look like to you right now, Dana? Or what would you judge as traders getting a bit more defensive? Because we have already seen yields move lower, so more and more people buying bonds. But there hasn't been this fear creeping into the market, even though we're seeing less breadth, unless if you consider these high-flying tech stocks, if they are now one of these almost safety plays for traders.
Yeah, anything that can go down and go down a lot is not a safety trade for us. There's a difference between safety and what and the prevailing trend. So things that are an uptrend, I wouldn't necessarily call them safety trades or flight to safety. I would call them the relative strength in the market right now, which we want to maintain positions in those areas. But in terms of trying to protect our capital in a really bad market, we're not going to be rushing to those areas of the market that are necessarily just on a relative basis outperforming. We're going to want to actually take true defensive measures, like raising cash, putting on hedges, and that type of thing that is truly defensive in a bad market. So we've been doing some of that. We've lowered our overall exposure substantially over the last few weeks, and looking again, like I said, looking to pick up some pennies and some singles here and there throughout the trading range, and wait for a better opportunity to really load up again, a better risk reward opportunity ahead of a likely another up leg. So as far as some of the safety, one factor that you alluded to, we don't see sentiment really getting fearful yet. It's actually some of the longer term sentiment figures are historically overly bullish, so that's a concern, but that's longer term. In the shorter term, we're not seeing a spike in those fear levels. So if we were, I'd feel more comfortable about buying into this, even with the breadth divergences. But the fact that we're not seeing fear spike, we're not seeing a rush to safety, combine that with the breadth divergences, and I think there's significant amount of risk here in the near term.
Okay, but it sounds like you still have this overall bullish attitude towards these markets, that there could easily be another leg higher even after this historic run. Is there another time in history that you've seen markets like this after a quick crash, or just that upward momentum that they have had, but now the breadth really waning?
It's a little bit unusual in that the breadth up until, you know, a couple months ago, really a month ago, breadth was really outstanding. Almost everything in the market was doing well. So for breadth to go from outstanding to falling off the table is very unusual historically. And it does give us, from what precedents we can find, does give us some comfort that we're probably not at an imminent, like, major top. I guess that's my overall theme, my emphasis in expecting another up leg eventually. The signs don't point to an imminent major top, more so an intermediate top, followed by probably another up leg into a major top. But it is unusual. Like I said, only because breadth was so good, participation was so strong, almost a breadth thrust like after the election, and then just recently has really deteriorated sharply. So I would guess a near term, some near term weakness, corrective action, followed by another attempted up leg before any major top is likely.
Dana, do you see any sectors out there that you consider undervalued, that you think are getting ignored by the market? That I know it's not really your strategy to try to pick a bottom or try to find some of these underappreciated sectors, but is there anything out there that's at least floating around in your mind saying, man, there's an opportunity here?
Well, we don't, like you mentioned, we don't look at fundamentals at all. We don't look at valuations at all. So if things are going down, probably going down for a reason. Things are going up, that's when we want to be on top of things. There does come a time when things get so bad, and if they're hitting some key technical levels that are significant, that we think warrant action on the chart, then we will take a stab at it. Typically that's not our MO, as you mentioned, but I would say one area right now, maybe for a short-term bounce, we're looking at the cannabis industry. Some of the cannabis ETFs are hitting some, they've been getting beat up pretty good. They're hitting some potential Fibonacci support, some potential like knife-catching support, at least for a short-term bounce. So we have put some money to work there and today and yesterday, just looking for at least maybe a short-term bounce.
Okay. Hey, Dana, great chatting with you, buddy. I know it's really can be kind of tough to trade some of these markets, especially when they're that slow and boring, but I think that you have a pretty good strategy here of hitting singles, right? This is not the time to get too aggressive in these markets because, well, quite frankly, they're just not going anywhere, or at least with any sort of strong momentum, and that could just be because we are in summer. Dana, as always, thanks for your time, buddy. We'll chat again in another couple weeks. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Sounds great, Corey. You too, bud.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report, and we're going to continue to focus on kind of the big picture environment here for markets, encompassing the data that we've been seeing and the lack of movements in terms of the Fed, but other central banks this week did start to taper, and we even had one kind of surprise where we got a full-on winding down of a QE program. I am chatting right now with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. Now, Mike, again, big picture for these markets. I continue to hear a lot of negative comments about the markets because of the lack of breadth. The number of stocks that are holding these markets up and even grinding them higher seem to be fewer and fewer, and they seem to be really focused on big tech. Now, the fact of the matter is we are really in the middle of summer trading, it feels like. Volumes have declined, and quite frankly, this is sometimes what we see, a more concentrated effort into some of the bigger name stocks. And again, these high-flying tech stocks, they really seem to be the place where when traders want to shut off their screens, they just put some money to work in these big tech stocks. Let's start off general market environment. Mike, what do you take away from this summer trading that we're seeing right now?
Sure. You know, you're absolutely right in terms of market breadth just not being as impressive as it was earlier this year. When I go through kind of the portfolio and Safe Money and just, you know, all of the different kinds of stocks and sectors I follow, I see that there are quite a few of them lagging. I mean, you can see something like the Russell 2000, small cap stocks underperforming. But you do have those big cap tech names, or, you know, the old FANG names we used to call them, that have been the go-tos for people to buy. Some of that stems from, you know, the interest rate pressure. I mean, these sort of infinite multiple, high multiple tech companies, to some degree, are dependent on what's happening with interest rates. The higher rates go, the higher growth picks up, the more people rotate into cyclicals and sell tech as those long-term interest rates rise. What we've seen more recently is, you know, despite some incredibly strong inflation readings, We've seen longer-term interest rates actually moderate over the last 4 or 5 months. They first flatlined the yield curve, then they sort of topped out and started rolling over a little bit. The yield curve is flat, and then all those are kind of contrary to what you might expect to happen when you get really strong inflation data. But what that's done is spilled over into reviving some of those old trades. You know, buy high multiple tech, companies that aren't as cyclical; they're more secular growers. Buy things like rotate some money back into things like utilities, and especially real estate investment trusts. REITs have done very, very well recently because, you know, when you remove that sort of upward pressure on long-term interest rates, it removes some of the downward pressure on those rate-sensitive stocks and sectors. So again, it's sort of the return to those trades that we had many, many moons ago. And what that has done concurrently is sort of leave the small caps and some of the financials by the wayside. They've started to lose some ground here. So interesting market dynamic. Some of it's seasonal, some of it's rate driven, and some of it's just the fact that there's still money out there, excess liquidity out there, looking for a place to go. And in this case, it continues to flow back into stock. Occasionally, we get these little mini tantrums, the so-called Powell pivot that happened a few weeks back. But what happened? I mean, that sell-off lasted a couple of days, and then 48, 72 trading hours later, we're right back to the races in terms of big cap averages, S&P going right back to new highs. So it's still a market that's in this money flood environment. It's still a market where there's a lot of liquidity sloshing around. And all else being equal, that's going to tend to send the big cap major averages, the stocks that make up those averages, higher.
Mike, how much do we need to be paying attention to the aspect that markets are forward-looking, right? And we did get some inflationary moves and spikes, especially in the commodities, a year ago and even 6 months ago. But recently, as the data has come in and inflation has spiked in the actual data terms, we're not seeing that inflation trade anymore. Is this really all about the markets being forward-looking and already pricing in a way, some of that inflation, and now they're pricing in the transitory nature of the inflation potentially?
A couple things going on. Obviously, as you pointed out, we were at very depressed levels last March, April, May, whether that's commodity prices, stock prices, economic growth, all up and down the line. And then off those levels, 10-year interest rates essentially tripled from, 50 basis points to over 1.5 percentage points. We saw a lot of movement in whether it's commodities. I mean, things like lumber grabbed all the attention, but it wasn't just lumber. It was all the soft commodities. It was copper. It was, other metals that are economically sensitive and so on. And we also saw equities perform very well. But again, a lot of that was driven not just by sort of the rebound off the depths of the COVID-driven recession. It was also driven by expectations of huge fiscal stimulus. We're still talking about big fiscal spending numbers here in the U.S., but some of that, some of that is moderating a little bit because of some political resistance to the associated price tags. We've seen some of those, infrastructure type plays pull off. I mean, not, crash or anything serious, but you have seen, some of those names come off the boil. And on top of that, the other issue that you have with all these inflation figures is they're grabbing headlines. They're making, the media is getting increasingly hostile towards the Biden administration and the Federal Reserve's, stated stance that all this stuff is transitory. The media is doing it, public commentary is doing it. And what that does is it, again, builds in some political resistance. It kind of makes people think, is the Fed really going to be able to stick with this average inflation targeting program? Is the Biden administration really going to be able to continue to push through trillions of dollars of spending if there's more political and public resistance to it? So I think part of what's happening, particularly in the bond market, is people are saying, we're not going to get as much of this stimmy spending, or we're not going to get as much future inflation. So that's why, you've seen yields, again, going all the way back to February, kind of topping out at first moving sideways and now coming down somewhat. I think, again, it's just sort of a realization that there's a lot of long-term factors that are going to restrain growth, whether it's demographics, structural issues, all the debt we've piled on top of the economy. Some of those things you and I have talked about before, those long-term issues never went away. And now you have a shorter-term issue of maybe a little less stimulus money coming in. Maybe the Fed being forced to kind of, throw a bone to the anti-inflationist and talk a little tougher. So all that coming together flattens the yield curve, and it tends to change which kinds of stocks are leading and which kinds of stocks are lagging, which we've already kind of covered a little bit here. It's those long-term rate-sensitive names, whether it's tech, utilities, REITs, and so on. They're starting to find buyers again. And I would also throw precious metals and mining shares in there after a pretty rough stretch after that, sort of the Powell tough talk that we got. Now even those are starting to base a little bit here and turn up a little bit. So it all kind of points to, again, you remove that long-term interest rate pressure, you're going to get some of those rate-sensitive names that are going to attract buyers again.
Do you take anything away from some of the central bank announcements this week? The Reserve Bank in New Zealand surprisingly decided to end their QE program this month. Royal Bank of Canada, or the Bank of Canada, announced that they were trimming some of their QE purchases, didn't move their interest rates. Do you think any of these other central banks that are starting to get a little bit tighter, especially the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, do you think this carries over to the Fed at all?
I think what it likely does, potential here is take some of the steam out of the U.S. dollar. We've seen one of the reasons gold and silver had come down, and we saw some other related sectors suffer, was because the U.S. dollar popped on some of the assumption that maybe the Fed is going to pivot a little bit here. But if you have the Fed, and indeed you had Jay Powell coming out this week and talking down expectations really for doing much in the near and intermediate term future before Congress, but at the same time, a couple of these foreign central banks begin to take steps towards dialing back QE or actually doing it, then you could see the U.S. dollar start to roll over a little bit here. So I think what that, again, if that is sort of beneficial to those long-term rate-sensitive things and also to think to companies and sectors that do better when the dollar is declining, such as precious metals. So that's probably the impact we're going to see. I don't think the Fed is going to follow in the footsteps of some of these foreign central banks anytime soon. Powell is definitely taking sort of the Biden administration approach to employment and not worrying about inflation and so on. And all of his public remarks seem to be basically counter to that idea. They're going to try and be peremptory. So we'll have a few people, a few of the people sitting at the table in the Federal Reserve that are going to push back. For example, Dallas Fed, Kaplan has already talked a little tougher and so on. But the central core of the Fed, sort of where the locus of power is, those people don't seem to be ready to shift. So I don't think that they're going to follow what Canada has done or New Zealand has done anytime soon.
Yeah, you're right. Powell sure has been pretty steadfast with his comments and his stance on where inflation is going and what the Fed is doing. I don't know. It doesn't seem like we're going to get any drastic change from Powell or the Fed anytime soon, but who knows? Maybe they'll start talking the market in a different direction. So, Mike, do you see any major shifts, any major trends developing here as we progress through summer, which, again, circling back to my initial comment, seems to be like it's going to be a slow trading summer?
So, yeah, I think you definitely, even what's happening with the interest rate environment, is you want to be refocusing on those income-oriented stocks and sectors. You want to be refocusing on things that had maybe had a little bit of a lid on them because of rising interest rates, such as precious metal. If you see, the dollar begin to come off again, if you see yields begin to or continue to decline and the curve flatten, that's going to remove that sort of governor, that sort of cap that you had on some of those sectors. And that's going to make interest, yield oriented names perform even better. So I always liked them for their business prospects. Some of these higher yielding companies and sectors like REITs and utilities and so on. Now, if you remove the governor that was holding them back, you've got the potential for some nice gains in addition to just the fact you're clipping a better yield that you can get in the treasury market. So that's what I would focus on. And I think that's probably in addition to some of those big cap tech, those are probably some of the names and sectors that are going to do pretty well heading out the rest of the summer.
Okay. Hey, Mike, great having you on the show, buddy. We're going to wrap it up here. I want to thank everybody for tuning in on this weekend show. I know summer trading can be a little bit slow, but hey, we're still here commentating on the markets and trying to do a lot of company interviews too to keep everybody up to date on the moves and the work that's being done by a lot of these resource companies. And unfortunately, this is a time where the market isn't noticing a lot of good work being done. But as more investors come back, then look to those companies that have been putting out some good news and also understand this environment that we are in that I think Mike outlined perfectly. Mike, thank you, as always, for your time on this weekend show. Everybody, Mike, you included, I hope you all have a great weekend.
Thank you.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.